Bibles and turn with me to Genesis chapter 32.
Thank you.
Genesis chapter 32. We've been in the middle section of Genesis. We have been looking at the life of Jacob. We have been tracing God's faithfulness toward his people. We have been looking at a narrative portion of Scripture that teaches us who God is, what God is like, how God is working in the world, and what it means, what it looks like to walk by faith in God alone. All of that is wrapped up in all of these stories. We've seen it exemplified in the life of Abraham. We've seen it at work in the life of Isaac, and we've been watching it develop in the life of Jacob. This is what God has been teaching Jacob: who he is, what he wants from his people, what it looks like to live by faith. This is a work that God has been doing in the life of Jacob since chapter 28. God had set Jacob apart, just like he had Isaac and Abraham. He had set Jacob apart from before his birth to be the recipient of God's special blessing and covenant promise. As God had promised to make Abraham's descendants numerous, so God had promised to make Isaac's descendants numerous and Jacob. God had promised that Jacob would be the son through whom God would continue to develop his redemptive plan, whose family line would be established that would ultimately reach to the Messiah, so that the gospel blessing that God promised to Abraham would be extended to all the nations. Jacob is a significant character. He is the covenant son of Abraham and Isaac. But Jacob was a scoundrel. While he was still in the womb, Jacob was causing trouble. Jacob was fighting with his brother Esau, even in the womb. And from the moment of his birth, Jacob proved to be a supplanter, a trickster, a deceiver for his own selfish gain, even as he clung to the heel of his brother Esau while they were delivered. This character trait of Jacob throughout his life created no small conflict within the family, so that even in chapter 28, after Jacob had swindled Esau out of his birthright and after he had stolen the family blessing on the firstborn from his brother Esau, Jacob is now forced to flee from his home to escape the murderous wrath of his brother, his twin brother, Esau. So Jacob flees. He goes to the land of Padan Aram, where his uncle Laban lives. And there Jacob is brought under the rule, if you will, of Laban. Jacob receives a strong dose of his own medicine as he endures 20 years of strained relationship and underhanded scheming from Laban, who was not only his uncle, but was now twice his father-in-law. That's what we see happening throughout this story. But in it all, we have noticed that the story is not ultimately about its human characters, that they are the canvas on which God is painting a much bigger picture. In it all, we have noted how God has been slowly breaking Jacob down in his character, bringing him to the end of himself, so that he would set his hope and his heart on God alone, so that he would live for him, so that he would walk in his ways. What we have been seeing God do in the life of Jacob is the work that God does in all of his people, to bring us to the end of ourselves so that we trust in him and walk according to his ways and according to his purpose. And what we have seen along the way is that God is not only interested in the end result, the end destination. But he is also interested in the formation of his people all along the way, the building of godly character in his people all along the way. This is why he orders circumstances the way he does. This is why he orders the events and the experiences of our lives the way he does. Not just to lead us to our ultimate heavenly home, but to transform us into godly character all along the way. It is all on purpose. Now, in chapter 28, God appeared to Jacob in a dream, and he made an Abrahamic promise to him, a promise that goes hand in hand with the covenant he made with Abraham. He promises Jacob that wherever he goes, God will be with him, and that God will bring him back to the land of his father. But for the next 20 years of Jacob's life, we see almost no acknowledgement of God from Jacob. As he lives under the hand of Laban, and as he schemes to get what he wants and to prosper under the hand of Laban, there seems to be almost no awareness of God in Jacob's mind whatsoever until the very end. But then God appears to him, and Jacob starts to realize that God has prospered him. God is the one who has been working in his life. God is delivering him from the oppression of Laban. God is the one who is now leading him back to the land of his father. And all along the way, we see that God has also been maturing him in his understanding of God, just as he had promised. So by this point, when we get to chapter 32, Jacob has begun to acknowledge God's hand of providence in protecting him, in providing for him, and in preserving him all along the way. He's begun to acknowledge that. And now in chapter 32, it all comes to a head. And Jacob finally comes to that point of submission, of yielding to the God who has been at work in his life all this time. This, in chapter 32, I believe, is the climax point of Jacob's story. And it all centers on a midnight encounter with God himself. And so we look at chapter 32. If you'll follow along as I read this text. Jacob went on his way, and the angels of God met him. So he's just left from his encounter with Laban. He's on his way back, and the angels of God met him. And when Jacob saw them, he said, "This is God's camp." So he called the name of that place Mahanaim, which means two camps. And Jacob sent messengers before him to Esau, his brother, in the land of Seir, the country of Edom, instructing them, "Thus you shall say to my lord Esau, thus says your servant Jacob, I have sojourned with Laban and stayed until now. I have oxen, donkeys, flocks, male servants, and female servants. I have sent to tell my lord in order that I may find favor in your sight." And the messengers returned to Jacob, saying, "We came to your brother Esau, and he is coming to meet you. And there are 400 men with him." Then Jacob was greatly afraid and distressed. He divided the people who were with him and the flocks and herds and camels into two camps, thinking, "If Esau comes to the one camp and attacks it, then the camp that is left will escape." And Jacob said, "O God of my father Abraham and God of my father Isaac, O Lord, who said to me, 'Return to your country and to your kindred, that I may do you good,' I am not worthy of the least of all the deeds of steadfast love and all the faithfulness that you have shown to your servant. For with only my staff I crossed this Jordan, and now I have become two camps. Please deliver me from the hand of my brother, from the hand of Esau, for I fear him, that he may come and attack me, the mothers with the children. But you said, 'I will surely do you good and make your offspring as the sand of the sea, which cannot be numbered for multitude.' So he stayed there that night. And from what he had with him, he took a present for his brother Esau. 200 female goats and 20 male goats. 200 ewes and 20 rams. 30 milking camels and their calves. 40 cows and 10 bulls. 20 female donkeys and 10 male donkeys. These he handed over to his servants, every drove by itself, and said to his servants, "Pass on ahead of me, and put a space between drove and drove." He instructed the first, "When Esau, my brother, meets you and asks you, 'To whom do you belong? Where are you going? And whose are these ahead of you?' Then you shall say, 'They belong to your servant Jacob. They are a present sent to my lord Esau, and moreover, he is behind us.'" He likewise instructed the second and the third and all who followed the droves, "You shall say the same thing to Esau when you find him. And you shall say, 'Moreover, your servant Jacob is behind us.' For he thought, 'I may appease him with the present that goes ahead of me. And afterward I shall see his face. Perhaps he will accept me.' So the present passed on ahead of him, and he himself stayed that night in the camp." The same night he arose and took his two wives, his two female servants, and his 11 children, and crossed the ford of the Jabbok. He took them and sent them across the stream and everything else that he had, and Jacob was left alone. And a man wrestled with him until the breaking of the day. When the man saw that he did not prevail against Jacob, he touched his hip socket, and Jacob's hip was put out of joint as he wrestled with him. Then he said, "Let me go, for the day has broken." But Jacob said, "I will not let you go unless you bless me." And he said to him, "What is your name?" And he said, "Jacob." Then he said, "Your name shall no longer be called Jacob, but Israel, for you have striven with God and with men and have prevailed." Then Jacob asked him, "Please tell me your name." But he said, "Why is it that you ask my name?" And there he blessed him. So Jacob called the name of the place Peniel, saying, "For I have seen God face to face, and yet my life has been delivered." The sun rose upon him as he passed Penuel, or Peniel, limping because of his hip. Therefore, to this day, the people of Israel do not eat the sinew of the thigh that is on the hip socket, because he touched the socket of Jacob's hip on the sinew of the thigh. So in this account, Jacob has left Laban and he has begun his journey toward his homeland once again. But I find it interesting that along the way, he seems to make a slight detour. And it seems that it's for the purpose of meeting up with Esau. And I think that, as we'll see in a few moments, that Jacob's purpose here is to set things right with his brother. But that encounter doesn't come until chapter 33. God has something else he wants to do in this little detour. Something that is more important, something bigger that he wants to accomplish first. God is going to use this detour as a moment to confront Jacob and finally bring him to his breaking point. And so while much of this chapter's context is about preparing to meet Esau, what it turns out to be is a crucial moment of spiritual transformation for Jacob that gets at the heart of his real need. I want us to work through this chapter in four aspects or four areas of Jacob's life that focus on the work of transformation God is doing, not just in Jacob, but in all of his people. We looked last week at the first aspect of this, and that is the reminder of spiritual reality. The reminder of spiritual reality. We saw that in verses 1 and 2. Much like what happened in Jacob's dream back in chapter 28, here the angels of God come and meet with Jacob. Only in chapter 28 it was a dream. Here it's the real thing. Now I don't know what they did with him. I don't know what they said during that meeting, but I do know it was a moving experience for Jacob because he renames the place Mahanaim. He calls it two camps, recognizing that he is not the only one who is there, that he is surrounded by, as it were, the host of God himself. This is his way of acknowledging that God is real, that he is there, that he is with him, that he is at work, that he is providing for him and protecting him, and that God is indeed keeping his promise to him. So this is a great milestone for Jacob. He's finally acknowledging the reality of God and the presence of God and the work of God all around him. It's the first time he has done this, really, in any meaningful way since chapter 28. And we noted last week that this is often where true spiritual transformation begins, with the recognition of the reality of the spiritual world and the work of God in everything, through everything, above everything, all around everything, even when all we can see is the physical world. That God is still there. And one of the things that God has been doing in Jacob all these years and throughout all these chapters is showing him that there is a spiritual reality. He prospered Jacob, not because he put the carved sticks in the troughs, but because God chose to set his favor on him. He gave him many children, not because of the mandrakes, but because God set his hand of favor on him. And God is showing him this over and over and over again, that this life is not just made up of the physical world that we see with our eyes. This is why the scriptures teach that God's people live by faith and not just by sight. Now, the next thing I want us to see here is in Jacob's transformation process is not just the reminder of the spiritual reality, but also the lesson of human experience. The lesson of human experience. We see this in verses 3 through 8, and then again in verses 13 through 21. And what I mean to highlight here is that there's something about Jacob's plans and efforts that not only brings him to the end of himself as he realizes how hopeless he is to defeat Esau and 400 men, but there's something different here in the preparation that he makes. Something we haven't seen in the previous chapters of Jacob's life. There is something that Jacob learns here in the midst of all this. Some of what he does here at first seems to be the same old Jacob. Self-preservation, self-confidence as he makes this plan for Esau's arrival. But there are some key differences. And it begins in verses 3 through 8 with the prospect of conflict. The arrival of distressing news heading Jacob's way. In verse 3, Jacob sent messengers before him to Esau, his brother, in the land of Seir, the country of Edom. Now that's an interesting little piece of information. I've already suggested it along the way. If you think about the geography of this, Jacob had started out way northeast of the Sea of Galilee. If you're looking at a map of Israel, Jacob starts out northeast of the Sea of Galilee, and he's traveling to the area around Judea. And the typical way of traveling would have been like what Abraham did, or what Abraham's servant did when he brought Rebekah back for Isaac as a wife, to travel down through what we know of as the land of Israel, west of the Jordan River. But Jacob's not doing that here. Jacob is focusing east of the Jordan River, and the land of Edom is southeast of the Dead Sea. So if you look at a map and visualize that, there is no need geographically for Jacob to go near Esau. And there's no need for him to communicate with Esau whatsoever in his trek back to the land of his father. And yet, here is Jacob initiating contact with Esau, and he seems to be going out of his way in order to communicate with him, in order to talk with him, even face to face. Why? Why? I think what we're seeing here is the beginning of the evidence that Jacob is changing. That he is no longer the schemer and the deceiver that he once was. But he is now seeking to make things right with his estranged brother. After all, it is a common evidence of the work of the Spirit in a believer's life that they strive to reconcile broken relationships. So, he sends these messengers to Esau, and he sends them with a message. We see that in verses 4 and 5. He announces, I've been with Laban. God has prospered me. I have all these things. And by the way, the listing of all the animals, that was a measure of wealth. I have prospered. And I have sent these servants to you, he says, that I might find favor in your sight. And that is the key here, that Jacob's intention is to find favor in Esau's sight. Jacob knows that his previous life was a wreck, that he had broken relationships, that he had harmed others, namely Esau. And it appears here that he is attempting to make things right. It is an indication not only of Jacob's need, but of Jacob's awareness of his need for reconciliation, even atonement, to make things right. But as we're going to see, his human effort is not enough to accomplish this. It's just not enough. This will turn out to be an important picture of his spiritual need before God as well. And we'll see that as the passage goes on. Well, he sends the messengers. In verse 6, the messengers return with disturbing news. Messengers return and they say, we came to your brother Esau and he is coming to meet you. That's good news, right? That means he's going to have his opportunity to bury the hatchet with his brother. But then they say, and there are 400 men with him. Your brother is coming to meet you with 400 men. Now, it would be one thing for Esau to come alone or with a few servants. That would be normal. That would be what was expected. But when Jacob hears that Esau has come or is on his way with 400 men, it becomes a whole new issue. Remember what Jacob knows about Esau right now. First of all, he knows he is an impulsive, short-sighted brute. That's the Esau he knew. He is a beast of a man. He is a mighty hunter who knows how to break stuff and kill things. His last words concerning Jacob were that he would kill him the next time he saw him. And now in response to Jacob's contact, Esau is now coming to meet Jacob with 400 men. The standard number of a common militia. For all Jacob can tell, nothing has changed with Esau, and his murderous intentions are still alive. So, in verse 7, we read what we would expect. Jacob was greatly afraid and distressed. I think it's an understatement, and we would all be afraid and greatly distressed too. So Jacob snaps into action and he makes a plan. After all, he is a schemer. Verses 7 and 8, he divides the people who are with him. And his thought is, if he attacks one, at least the other will be safe. After all, I have two wives. I might as well keep one of them, right? He knows he has no chance of defeating a force of 400 men. His only hope is that he can divert the hostility in one direction or another so as to rescue part of his family. That's what he's doing. That brings us to verses 13 to 21, where the prospect of conflict moves Jacob now to prepare for the conflict. Through the night and on into the next day, Jacob is not only dividing his family, but he's also preparing a present for Esau. And it's quite the present. More than 550 animals he sends, male and female alike. So he not only sends him animals, but he sends animals that are ready to reproduce and grow and become greater wealth. This is quite a present. It's a substantial gift. Verses 16 to 21 explain how Jacob divides this into several waves to present to him one at a time. Remember, he knows Esau is a temporal thinking kind of brutish guy, and so he's just going to overwhelm him wave after wave after wave of gift in order to appease him, so that his wrath will dissipate. That's Jacob's goal. But here's what I want us to notice in all of this. Jacob has been a schemer and a planner and a calculator his whole life. And that tendency comes into view again here. He's good at it. But there's something significantly different. For one thing, Jacob is not scheming here for shameless self-promotion. He's not cheating anybody out of anything. In fact, for the first time, he's giving stuff away. He's giving away substantial wealth. He knows the impulsiveness and the materialism of his brother, so he tries to make peace this way. But the only thing that he is scheming about at this moment is protecting his family. That's his concern. So yes, we do learn something here, that it is appropriate, even for God's people, to scheme, if you will, to make plans for their benefit in this present world. That's not the problem here. And I think we're seeing evidence of that here, of transformation in the way Jacob is doing this, that God is at work. Yes, he is exerting his own effort to remedy the situation, kind of like how he has manipulated all along. But this time it's different. He has a new focus. He has a transformed motivation. He is being generous. He is not merely being self-serving. But I think also for another thing, we need to realize that Jacob has come to the awareness that he is helpless in this situation to defend himself against Esau. Sure, he's making a desperate attempt. But it will soon become clear that this situation has brought Jacob to the end of himself. This is indeed a desperate attempt. I'm not going to keep my whole family. My only hope is that I can keep some of them. That's his thought. And this human effort to make this plan and to present this gift actually brings Jacob now to the end of himself, to where he is ready to cry out in desperate dependence for deliverance. And that brings us to the third aspect that I want us to see here. Jacob does something here that he has not done before. Something that is a first. He prays. Smack dab in the middle of his human effort, in the middle of his plans and his preparations, he prays. In verses 9 through 12. And that's the third thing I want us to notice about how God is transforming Jacob and how he transforms his people. It has to do with the centrality of divine dependence. He makes the human effort, but what is at the heart of all this now is divine dependence. Learning to depend on God for deliverance, for provision, and guidance, even in impossible circumstances. It is here, in this prayer, that we really begin to see what God is doing in his heart and mind. Jacob, though he makes his best preparations, appears that he is no longer depending only on himself. He is depending on God. Now, it may not be perfect dependence yet. It seldom is for God's people. But divine dependence is at the centerpiece now of his thinking as he prepares for whatever he is about to face. And Jacob prays in verses 9 through 12. And as he prays, he focuses on four crucial realities. That he's not just crying out, Lord, make my plans work out according to the way I want them to. No, he is praying a prayer of substance. His prayer reflects, his prayer shows that he's getting it now. He's starting to understand. First of all, in verse 9, as Jacob prays, he acknowledges who God is. And he's bringing it closer to home now for the first time. Jacob said, O God of my father Abraham and God of my father Isaac. He's acknowledged that much before. But then he says, O Lord. That's all capitals. O Yahweh. That's the covenant name of God. That is for the use of his people. O Lord, who said to me, you're not just the God of Abraham and Isaac. You've spoken to me. Now, this may not exactly be Jacob calling him my Lord just yet, but he is awfully close. Can you see it? He is acknowledging the reality of God. He is acknowledging the covenant of God. He is acknowledging the goodness and faithfulness of God here. Throughout this prayer, he is acknowledging the call and the leadership of God in his life. In this time of fear and desperation, Jacob is recognizing and acknowledging and depending on who God is. And with that in mind, this awareness of who God is, in verse 10, Jacob also acknowledges what man is, what he is. He says, "I am not worthy of the least of all the deeds of steadfast love and all the faithfulness that you have shown to your servant. I am an unworthy servant." Have we seen Jacob say that yet? No, this is a new step for him. And he acknowledges, "On my own, I had nothing but this staff. Now I'm two camps. Now my family and my possessions are big enough that I can divide them into two groups and hope to save one." What a transformation in his thinking. This deceiver and self-promoting schemer is now acknowledging his unworthiness of God's grace. And he calls himself God's servant. And here he acknowledges that on his own he had nothing, and that anything he had was given to him only by God's undeserved, steadfast love and faithfulness. And here we see another crucial aspect, another crucial point of transformation for all of God's people. That moment when we recognize and acknowledge that we are nothing and that we have nothing apart from God. That on our own we are unworthy. As long as we think, beloved, that we are something, as long as we think that we have something to offer to the Lord, we will never rest in Him. We will never know His peace. For Jesus taught that it is the poor in spirit who receive the kingdom of God, who are the ones who are blessed. And Jacob has now been brought to the end of himself. That is how God converts his people. He brings them through the events of their lives, if need be, to the end of themselves, so that they cry out as little children in abject dependence upon him. And that is what he has done with Jacob. Times of crisis have a way of doing that, don't they? Making us cry out to the Lord. How good it would be for us to remember this even before the times of crisis hit. Who God is, what man is, and then verse 11, he goes on to acknowledge what man needs. Now, he doesn't have a full grasp yet of what his true need is, but the need he knows about, he presents to the Lord. So in verse 11, "Please deliver me from the hand of my brother, from the hand of Esau, for I fear him." He acknowledges his fear. He's honest about it. "I can't do this, Lord. I am fearful. But for the sake of the mothers and the children, deliver me from the hand of my brother." Now Jacob thinks this is his greatest need in the moment. We who are reading the story know that there's something bigger that God is working with. We'll find out in chapter 33 that the problem with Esau has already been solved. But God has something more important that he is doing in Jacob. Remember that God's ultimate purpose is not just the end result, just not just the destination, but the transformation along the way. God is concerned about the spiritual growth of his people in the midst of the trials. And so for Jacob, this trial is one that is meant to reveal a deeper need than simply deliverance from Esau. God is bringing Jacob to a realization of his need to stop fighting against God. That has been his problem all along. Jacob's problem hasn't been Esau. His problem wasn't Laban. His problem wasn't his two wives or their inability to have children. None of that was his ultimate problem. Jacob, for his whole life, was fighting against God. And everything we've seen in his life is a temporal picture of that. And Jacob is now coming finally to a realization that he needs to stop fighting against God as he had his whole life, and he needs now to start clinging to God as he will in verses 22 through 32. But this realization begins with acknowledging his abject dependence upon God in the present crisis. And it will grow from there. Friends, what's the crisis you're dealing with today? And are you seeing in that crisis something God is doing to bring you to the end of yourself to cry out to him in dependence? And all of this leads to verse 12 when Jacob now acknowledges not only who God is and who he is, but and not only what man needs, but now what God can do. He says to the Lord, but you said, I will surely do you good and make your offspring as the sand of the sea, which cannot be numbered for multitude. Jacob finds his relief and his hope and the substance of his prayer in the words that God had given to him already. Jacob is not putting his trust in his own efforts. Lord, deliver me from Esau because I've made all these strong provisions. No. Deliver me from Esau because you told me you're going to make my offspring like the sand of the seashore. You told me you're going to do good. Jacob makes his appeal to God according to God's own words. He has come to a point of utter dependence, and now he is beginning to take God at his word, and he is praying God's word back to him. A practice we all would do well to embrace. And notice that the words of God to which Jacob appeals here are the words that he spoke to Abraham in his covenant. These are the words that he spoke to Isaac. These are the words that he has spoken to Jacob, that Jacob is now taking these covenant words and applying them to himself. You didn't just say this, Father, Heavenly Father. You didn't say this, Yahweh, just to Abraham, to Isaac. You've said it to me, and now I'm claiming them is my basis for praying to you now. Jacob's mind and his heart and his identity are changing toward God's centeredness. In this moment of crisis, Jacob has now learned to cry out to God, to focus on who God is, to remember who he is in light of who God is, to consider what his real need is. God's going to reveal that to him in a moment. But he is learning now to set his hope on what God can do and to trust in what God has promised. And though he is doing his best to plan and prepare wisely, Jacob is not taking matters into his own hands here. He is orienting himself around who God is and what he believes God will do. Truly, here is the beginning of faith in all of God's people, coming to the end of ourselves and crying out to God in dependence and faith to deliver us and to bless us. Now that brings us to the last section of this chapter, verses 22 through 32. And you would think that after all this buildup, after all this preparation, after the reminder of God's presence and the threat of conflict and Jacob's careful prayer and dependence upon the Lord for deliverance, you would think that this section would end by saying something like this. And Esau arrived, and he received the gifts, and the two brothers were reconciled, and they lived happily ever after. But in fact, the resolution to this human conflict doesn't even occur in this chapter. It isn't until chapter 30. We don't see the resolution to that part of the story until the next chapter. There is something else that must happen first. And it is here that we see the fourth aspect of God's work in his people, and it is the goal of spiritual transformation. Remember this, beloved. God's primary purpose in your life is not to deliver you from your hardships, but to transform you through them. There is a greater conflict on the horizon for Jacob, one that he does not see coming. He sees Esau coming, but there's something greater that is ahead of him. Jacob's confrontation with Esau, frankly, has already been taken care of by God. It's already worked out, as we'll see. But God's work here is focused on something else. He has another fight ahead of him, something that is far more important. God is focused on the spiritual transformation of his child. And it all comes to a head in these verses, 22 through 32. Not with Jacob meeting Esau, but with Jacob meeting God himself. Not in a vision, not in a dream, not mediated by angels. Just Jacob and God alone in the wilderness. And what has happened throughout Jacob's life to this point, the scheming, the manipulation, the selfishness, the conflict, has been a picture of his relationship with God, ultimately. And what happens in these verses is a picture of what God is doing in his spiritual life all around to change him in every facet of his life. So in verses 22 through 24, we see the conflict. In verse 22, he takes the rest of his family, and there's this little offshoot stream from the Jordan River called the Jabbok. And Jacob takes his family and he walks them across that little stream. And then Jacob comes back over alone. Verse 24 tells us that there a man wrestled with him until the breaking of the day. This time the fight wasn't by Jacob's initiation, but it is a fight nonetheless. This fight lasts all night long, but the question is, who is this mystery man? Was it Esau? Had Esau arrived in the area early and now he sneaks in at night to take him out? Or was this some random bandit who came to pillage the camp? We find out who this man is when we come to verses 25 through 27 and we see the climax of the fight. This fight goes on all night long. Now keep in mind, Jacob is probably about 90 years old. And he has enough strength left in him to fight with this man all night long. That tells me Jacob's pretty strong. But it also tells me God's probably fighting with his hand tied behind his back. Right, we'll see that in a moment. But here's the climax. Verse 25, when the man saw he did not prevail against Jacob, he touched his hip socket. There it is. He touched his hip socket. And Jacob's hip was put out of joint as he wrestled with him. He just touches his hip socket and it falls out of joint. So we read that when we see that this man did not prevail against Jacob, we're not being told it was because Jacob was stronger or that this man wasn't strong enough to defeat him. We find out actually he wasn't wrestling with Jacob for the purpose of defeating him. He had another purpose in mind. This man, after a long night of wrestling, simply touches Jacob's hip socket and puts it out of joint. That touch really is just, the idea is just a simple swipe. Nothing we would think would injure the man. But then we come to the realization that only God could cripple a man that easily. And that's what we need to see here. It appears that this man wrestled all night with Jacob, not for the purpose of defeating him, but for the purpose of breaking him and his stubborn will. And some of you have worked with people like Jacob before, and you know that that one of the greatest things they could ever do is box all night and make no progress and wear themselves out so that they fall down in exhaustion, realizing they cannot win. Sometimes that's the only way people learn. And that's what happens with Jacob. And though the text says that this man did not prevail against Jacob in the physical wrestling, it does indicate that it was within his power to win in that way. Because all he did was touch him on the hip. When God decided the fight was over, it was over. But the text also indicates that this man did prevail in the spiritual battle that was going on. With the simple touch that put Jacob's hip out of joint, the text shows us what I'm sure Jacob realized in that moment. This man was God. And with this realization, in verse 26, God ended the wrestling match and began to go away, but Jacob, as it were, clings to him and says, I will not let you go unless you bless me. Picture the scene in your mind. It's a major transformation in Jacob's demeanor here. Picture it. Jacob wrestles all night, no doubt angry and in a rage. Men, you know what I'm talking about. You'd be angry fighting, trying to get victory over this guy. He wrestles all night with this one who turns out to be God, who is there as a theophany or a Christophany, a pre-incarnate appearance of God on the earth. And Jacob wrestles valiantly, still strong and scrappy in his old age. But then God ends the fight by touching his hip, and now Jacob falls to the ground, unable to get up again, writhing in pain, and yet it appears he will not let go. But now he's no longer trying to defeat the Lord. He's now desperately hanging on for a blessing. And in verse 27, God tells Jacob to say his name. And he answers, Jacob. And he makes Jacob deal with the reality that he has to face, that as his name is, so is he. Your name is deceiver. Your name is supplanter. And so you are. And this is enough, Jacob. And when he gets him to say his name, that is an act of subjugation over this one with whom he was fighting. And Jacob, in giving his name, is an act of submission. It's Jacob's way of tapping out. After all these years, Jacob has finally come to the end of himself. He has stopped fighting against God, and he is now clinging to him in desperation, begging for his blessing and his grace and his mercy. He has finally yielded to God. He's had the knowledge, the awareness has grown, and now the yielding has come. And then we come to verses 28 through 32, where we see the change, the real change that God produced in him. Nobody who comes to a point of conversion, who comes to a point of wrestling with God, no one who comes to a point like this with God leaves unchanged. No one who belongs to God remains unchanged. And what we see here in Jacob is a change both of his identity and his future. In verse 28, God changes Jacob's name to Israel, which means he fights with God. And the idea here is that moment of wrestling with God, when he yielded to him finally, this is going to become the defining moment of his life. This is when everything changed. This is when the old passed away and the new came. This is when he ceased being the trickster and started being the man who wrestled with God and yielded. The moment of conversion is a moment that is defining for all of God's people, and it will govern his identity from here forward. And the idea here that he prevailed against God is not that he was stronger than God, but that this moment brought him to that point of transforming submission to the Lord. And it shows us God always gets his way with his people. He will do what it takes to break his people and bring them to joyful submission to him for their good and for his glory. And then in verse 29, Jacob asks the man's name. God had already asked him his name. Now Jacob wants him to return the favor. And it reminds me of that moment when Moses asks for God to show him his glory. And God says, no man can look at my glory and live. God doesn't give his name here, not because he doesn't want Jacob to know him, but because he wants Jacob to understand that they are not on equal footing. That Jacob is not yielding to an equal. He is submitting to God. And then when he realizes that, God blesses him. And in verse 30, Jacob names that place Peniel, which means face of God. And Jacob says that it has the idea of seeing God face to face. I have seen God face to face and I've lived to tell about it. That will change a man. It's Jacob's acknowledgement and his memorial to what has happened here. And then in verses 31 and 32, the sun rises, God departs, though he's always present, and Jacob limps along. And from here forward, his limp will be a constant reminder, a constant memorial to that moment of conversion, that moment of wrestling with God, and finally yielding to his authority, his leadership, and his purpose. God's main purpose in Jacob's life was not deliverance from his earthly strife and fear, but to break him of his self-confidence and his selfish ambition so that he wouldn't just know true things about God, but that he would yield to God in submission and service, that his heart, soul, mind, and body would be given over to God alone as his master and Lord. Can you start to see what the significance of a passage like this might be for us today? In all of this, we see a picture of how God works in the lives of his people and what his purposes are for us. We've seen a reminder of the spiritual reality behind all that we see in this world, that God is there and that God is at work. We have seen how God uses human experiences to bring his people to the end of themselves so that they stop looking to themselves and they start looking to him alone. We have seen how God leads his people to recognize that he is their God, that they are unworthy servants, that they desperately need his salvation, and that he is able to save all who believe in him and trust in him alone. And we have seen how God does what is necessary to lovingly bring us to a point of yielding, to a point of dependence, a point of new identity and becoming a new creation in him. So my question is this: at what point of wrestling with God are you this morning? Friends, you have knowledge of God. Jacob had knowledge of God. You might even acknowledge God to a certain degree. Jacob did that too. But have you come to a point of yielding to him? Teenagers, your parents' faith will not get you into heaven. You must yield to the Lord. Adults, your tithing won't get you to heaven. Your good works won't get you to heaven. Your presence in this room won't get you to heaven. You must yield to God as your Lord. Your theological astuteness and knowledge will not get you there. You must yield. What is God doing in your life to break you from your attachment to this world, to remove from you your confidence and your self-effort, so that all you have left to do is cling to him? Clinging to him with nothing to offer is a desperate place to be, but it is the safest place to be. And it is there that God brings to you a new name, a new identity, a new promise. What is God doing in your life to bring you to the end of yourself so that you will yield to him? Do you even realize that that's what he's doing? The message of this text is that God works to bring his people, to break his people of sinful self-reliance and sinful self-interest so that they will yield to him in trusting, transforming faith. And God's call to us from this text is this: to remember God, to depend on God, to yield our lives to God every moment, every need, every fear, in simple faith and trust and obedience. In other words, God is orchestrating every part of your life right here, right now, today, this week, to cause you to look away from your attachment and love for this world so that you will love him with all of your affection and all of your energy and all of your stuff. And there are several levels of response here that build on one another. It begins with acknowledging God, that he's real, that he's there, that he's always at work. And then it moves to believing God, taking that knowledge and applying it to yourself, taking God at His word and trusting in Him there. And it moves from there to claiming God as your own. You're not just the God of my father and my mother. You are my God. And then depending on God. Because you are my God. Because I trust you. I let go of my self-effort. And that is ultimately submission to God. Yielding to His plan. Yielding to His purpose. Yielding to His work. Yielding to His word. Are you yielding to Him as your master, as your Lord, as your Savior, as your God? Our Heavenly Father, we thank you for this time that we've